Hello and welcome to Didion Hawthorne in the In-Between, or DH&I. I'm your host, Mackenzie Gentz, and you're listening to our podcast about the relevance of literature in the 21st century. Now bookmark that book, and let's begin.
Good morning, my lovelies. It is the eve of finals week here at Northwestern, but that is no excuse for us not to talk about my love of forewords and introductions today, so let's get into it. Oh, by the way, our December Dickens reads will be The Old Curiosity Shop and David Copperfield, which we will be reviewing at the end of December to give us all time to read them, including myself, so thank you very much to all of you who voted and helped us decide on what to read. So my research for this week did not prove very fruitful for the episode because it turns out that there just aren't a lot of people out there who are interested in knowing the history of book forewords. Who would've thunk? But nevertheless, we're going to carry on as charged here. I also have to differentiate quickly the differences between introductions, forewords, and prefaces. Generally, it's agreed that introductions are written by the author and are part of the text itself. So in other words, introductions are part of the narrative structure of the book. Forewords, on the other hand, are not generally written by the author and serve to talk about things existential to the book, such as images, themes, tones and moods, symbols, and plot. Forewords are also written by someone imminent, quote, link in the description, so as to lend credibility to the book itself. Another way to differentiate these is that the Roman numeral numbers, the 1, 2, 3, in books, we'll start with the introduction if it's an introduction that's part of the narrative. So the actual characters that we would normally use as 1, 2, 3 would start on the first page of the introduction if it is part of the narrative, whereas we'll have the more numerals or weird sort of subscripts as part of the foreword. A preface, on the other hand, is not something that we're going to delve too deeply into for the duration of the episode, but it's essentially an acknowledgement section, which paradoxically is often relegated to the back of the book because many people don't find it to be as interesting, obviously, as the book's other content. My sense is that forewords to books didn't start appearing until the early to mid-20th century, which is incredibly late, I know, but my evidence is that the trade of foreword writing is something carried on from academia, the whole of which was not as prestigious or well-known in America until recently. I also cite really low literacy rates for a lot of the early, even 18th and 19th centuries. Today, if I were an author and I know Professor X or Academic X who teaches or does research at insert Ivy League here, I would ask him or her to endorse my book by writing a foreword. Most forewords that are endorsed directly by the authors or the publisher are actually more so anecdotal than academic. And a lot of times the academic type forewords are more summaries of the book, they have incredible plot spoilers, as I said previously, or are more analyses of the book itself. One of my favorite forewords of the more anecdotal type is at the beginning of The Person and the Situation by Rawson Nisbet, and the foreword written by Malcolm Gladwell there shares an anecdotal account about his first encounter with the book at the Bob's Library in New York City. But now there's the question of what about if the author is no longer living, if they've died, and we want to do a foreword for one of the books that they've written. Well, this situation is where we start to get into the nitty-gritty of publishing houses and things of this nature, which is probably content for another episode, but let's first take a look at what has become to be really a paradigm example of forewords to classics and classic literature, which is Barnes & Noble classics. The typical Barnes & Noble classics novel will have about a 30-page foreword to the text that serves as a plot summary and analysis of the book that you're about to read. My favorites from the editions I've read personally from Barnes & Noble's classics, and I've read many classics that aren't Barnes & Noble's classics as well. Maybe we can talk about that later. But they are Wuthering Heights and Oliver Twist. I think that the people who did the forewords for those just really did a good job, and they really illuminated a lot of things in the book that I might have not caught up on as a first-time reader. Now, due to the nature of academia, there's never going to be a dearge of, say, Dickens scholars totally willing, if not to adapt a lecture or other article that they've previously written, then to write one from scratch. So it's relatively easy nowadays for companies like Barnes & Noble's to call up the Faulkner scholar at X University and ask them to write a foreword for the new edition. If you, like me, are the type to read a book from cover to cover, including the introduction and foreword, then you are also likely to have picked up on the classic foreword format of old, which I won't get into because it's really boring. I actually find it interesting, though, that such a new practice with foreword writing became standardized so quickly. It's not like Joan Margaret over here wrote a text on foreword writing and everyone followed suit. The development of the foreword, especially in recent years, has taken place largely from the observation of other people writing forewords. Another thing about forewords is that they're generally commissioned when an author gets their own series of a book. So Kurt Vonnegut is the textbook example of this, in my opinion, where all of his novels in the early 2000s were reprinted so that their covers were all designed by the same artist, so that they have the same publisher as well. The books all have this very uniform look to them, and they look good together on the shelf. That's indeed the most convenient time to garner a new set of forewords, unless, of course, the author themselves has already written an introduction or a foreword themselves for the text. I've seen very few examples, actually, of authors who write forewords for their own books just for the sake of writing a foreword. It's often instead the case that the book has a special importance to them in some way, has a background story or influence that's not quite explained in the book, or is a new edition of the book that the publishers ask them to write a new foreword to introduce the new edition, for example, for such and such anniversary of the book. A perfect example of this is South and West by Joan Didion, where the book itself is published as a set of journals from, I want to say, the 1980s, and is stitched together with the help of both the author's foreword to the writings as well as her modern-day commentary, which is written and interspersed throughout the book. And then finally, we get to weirder, more modern forewords. I don't have my copy of South and West on me by Joan Didion, but I remember that the foreword of that book, not written by Joan Didion, written by a guy named Nathaniel Rich, was just really strange and deviated drastically, at least in my opinion, from typical foreword writing. If you're interested, I think what made this foreword interesting from my memory here is that his development of personal study and experience in conjunction with his insightful cues into the book, those two things joined together really made the introduction / foreword interesting to me. So I read the forewords of books first. I don't care about spoilers. I am someone who spoils and someone who doesn't mind when things are spoiled for me. So I'm a huge proponent of you should read the foreword first and get someone else's opinion on the book before you read it. It's sort of the same thing as watching a movie trailer before you watch the actual movie, because then you know from the style of trailer what genre the movie's gonna actually be, how the cuts maybe are gonna look, if there's humor in it, things like this. So I use it really as a cue into how the tone of the book is going to play out as a whole. Books are an incredible time crusher, you could say. The average person spends 8 to 10 hours on reading a novel, and I would say a typical novel is about 315 pages or so. So that would be around 6 hours, but if we're talking about, like, Dickens, for example, you probably spend about 10 hours reading a Dickens novel. And yeah, I think it's important and it's a valuable experience to be able to read the foreword before you read the book, just to get the tone of the book and, again, make sure that it's a worthwhile investment of your time. There is also an argument for not reading the foreword of the book first, of course, and that is in the service of really having an untainted experience as the author would have intended, right? So the author is not going to write the book intending that you know all of the deaths in the book, you know all of the characters already, you know all of the symbols and themes, and have read an analysis already, right? They want to write a book and to have this book be read by a pure quote-unquote audience. So that would be the argument against forwards. But I want to know what you guys think. There is a link in the description of this episode to our blog, and you can comment freely there about everything that has been mentioned today about forwards. Thank you guys very much for listening, and I will see you next week.
If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from me, there's a show and a series for everyone, so I'd recommend checking out our brand new website, relevanceofliterature.com, for links to our entire back catalog of episodes. You can also follow us on Twitter or join our Facebook group. Our handle is @DidianIn, 2 N's total for both of those. And finally, if you want to support the show, help keep it ad-free, and get access to our new private podcast, go to patreon.com/relevanceofliterature and sign up to become a sponsor. All of the relevant links, as always, are in the description box down below. Still there? One more thing then. Remember that leaving a comment or a review on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or any other Guilty Pleasure podcast platform helps leverage the show so that other literature enthusiasts can find the community. In other words, it helps a ton. Auf Wiederhören!